Welcome to our podcast, Tis But a Scratch, Fact and Fiction about the Middle Ages. I'm your host, Professor Richard Abels, and today we're going to be talking about Robin Hood. My co-host is a veteran of this podcast, Dr. Jennifer Paxton of the Catholic University of America. In our previous episode, Jenny and I talked about the origins of the Robin Hood legend and the possibility that Robin may have been based upon a real person. Today, Jenny and I are going to look at Robin Hood in the movies and television. Please join us. Welcome back, Jenny.
It's wonderful to be back, Richard.
This is a lot like our episodes about King Arthur. I enjoyed discussing the evidence for the historical Arthur, but what I really enjoyed was talking about King Arthur in the movies and the novels. So over the last few weeks, I watched some good movies about Robin Hood and some not-so-good movies about Robin Hood.
I did as well. When Ellen asked me why I was planted in front of the TV all day, I could tell her with a straight face, I'm doing research for the podcast. So let's get to it.
Let's do it.
We left off in the previous episode at the point, the 17th century, that all the elements of the Robin Hood story came together. As we explained, the historical Robin Hood, if he existed, and it's still possible that he was, as the collector of folk songs Francis James Child believed, absolutely a creation of the ballad muse, that the historical Robin Hood was an obscure tenant of the Archbishopric of York, who in the mid-1220s was for unknown reasons outlawed and his chattel forfeited to the crown. This was the conclusion of Sir James Clark Holt, perhaps the most distinguished British medieval historian of the second half of the 20th century. I still have some doubts. Not that I think that Robin Hood is an avatar of the Teutonic goblin Hoddekin or the British wood spirit Robin Goodfellow, but because the surname Hood might simply refer to the wearing of a hood to conceal identity. It's striking that in Tudor-era Robin Hood dress-ups, or as I like to think of it, cosplay, Robin and his band of merry men are clothed from head to toe in Lincoln green. The hood symbolized their outlaw status.
That's quite possible, but I don't think we really have to choose. What may have made the 13th century Robert Hood of York so attractive a candidate for legendary stories was his name. At any rate, we can't really connect any of the stories directly to this man. Richard is right when he says this guy is obscure. My sense is that the fame of the heroic bandit called Robin Hood grew, and as that happened, the stories of other good outlaws, both real and legendary, got attached to him.
We find echoes in the medieval Robin Hood legend of the activities of the 13th century political rebel and outlaw Roger Godbeard, as well as Eustace the Pirate and Hereward the Wake. Although we didn't mention it in the previous episode, one possible prototype for the Robin Hood legend is Willikind of the Weald. William of Cassington, or as he was popularly known, Willikin, was a member of the Kentish gentry. As described by the 13th century historian Roger of Wendover, this William was a devoted loyalist of King John who despised those who were not. When the rebel barons of Magna Carta fame invited Prince Louis of France to invade and depose John, William responded by gathering together in the Weald, that great royal forest that spread across Kent and Sussex, quote, a vast number of archers, all of them men of the region, and all the time they attacked and disrupted the enemy, and as a result of their intense resistance, many thousands of Frenchmen were slain, end quote.
Finally, a source for the Robin Hood story that emphasizes a band of archers, and it's set in the reign of King John.
The tale of Willikin of the Weald also answers one objection to a 13th century origin for Robin Hood. Joseph Hunter believed that Robin Hood had to have lived in the 14th century because it wasn't until the 14th century that the longbow came into use for hunting and warfare. Hunter was wrong about that. Willikin, in many ways, looks like Robin Hood. He may not have been an outlaw, but he behaved like one, hiding out in the forest with a band of men waylaying passersby. One might think of him as a guerrilla fighter, but the same can be said about Robin Hood's attacks upon the men of the Sheriff of Nottingham and the allies of the tyrant Prince John in Robin's efforts to preserve the kingdom for Richard. Of course, there is a slight problem here, as Willoughby of the Weald was a partisan of John and a ferocious enemy of those who opposed him.
How ironic.
Despite that, I wouldn't be surprised if elements of Willoughby's career and exploits were absorbed into the Robin Hood legend. The Robin Hood legend is a bit like the Frankenstein monster, stitched together from a lot of disparate body parts. The ballad makers took what they found useful and left out what they didn't.
After the first episode was posted, Richard and I talked about how the growth of the Robin Hood legend resembles the gravitational pull of a large planet.
More like a black hole than a large planet, since at its center is a figure about whom we know virtually nothing.
Just as Robin Hood attracted and absorbed the stories of other lesser-known outlaws, his tale was drawn into the orbit of the two English kings best known by the general public, Richard the Lionheart and Bad King John.
The process by which the Robin Hood legend was created and developed bears similarities in American folklore to the stories that grew up around historical Wild West outlaws such as Jesse James and Billy the Kid. There have been a lot of movies about both of these guys, and in most of these movies, it's the legendary rather than historical outlaws who are portrayed. It reminds me of a quotation from one of my favorite John Ford westerns, The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. The movie begins with the distinguished senator, Ransom Rance Stoddard, played by Jimmy Stewart, and his wife, played by Vera Miles, returning to the frontier town where the senator had begun his career to attend the funeral of a poor rancher named Tom Donovan, played by John Wayne. The senator's political career began when he achieved fame for having killed the notorious outlaw Liberty Valance in a showdown. The rest of the movie is the senator's confession to a reporter, this is shown in flashback, that it was really Tom Donovan who had shot the outlaw and in doing so saved Rance's life. Jimmy Stewart's Rance is an idealistic, pacifistic lawyer who wants to bring law and civilization to the frontier. John Wayne's Tom Donovan is a man of action and few words, a cowboy relic of a passing age. They both love the schoolteacher Hallie. Tom saves his rival because he knows that Hallie loves Rance and knows that the Sugarfoot lawyer has no chance in going up against a merciless gunslinger. It's a selfless act, made even more selfless by Tom's refusal to take credit. Reluctantly, Rance agrees to accept the lie and becomes a Western legend, the man who shot Liberty Valance. He marries Hallie, and his fame propels him to the U.S. Senate, where he can make his ideals reality. Tom Donovan remains on his ranch and dies in obscurity. At the end of the movie, the senator asks the reporter whether he will publish the true story.
Well, you're not going to use the story, Mr. Scott?
No, sir. This is the West, sir. When the legend becomes fact, print the legend.
He's right, Rance.
By the beginning of the 19th century, Robin Hood was so well known that he could make a cameo appearance in Sir Walter Scott's novel, Ivanhoe.
That's another very key transition point. So in the early 19th century, Sir Walter Scott is a revolutionary figure in the history of English literature. He essentially invents the historical novel. He writes a lot of novels that are set in the past, some more distant, some more recent. He writes about the Jacobites, etc. But he writes a couple of medieval novels. One of the most famous of these, probably the most famous one, is Ivanhoe, which gives us a cameo appearance by a figure named Robin Hood.
Yes.
And so he's taking this very popular legend, Robin of Locksley, right? A very popular figure who people probably know about, and puts him in the story of the dispossessed Walter of Ivanhoe, And interjects the very important feature of what will become the Robin Hood legend, which is the ethnic cleavage between Saxons and Normans.
Right.
So this is the idea that after the Norman conquest of 1066, you have this this persistence of a dynamic with a ruling class who are Norman and an oppressed underclass who are Saxon, and that is still very live, hasn't progressed at all in the 1190s, almost a century and a half. After the conquest, which is not accurate at all, but does fit very much a 19th century romantic view of the Anglo-Saxon past, which really saw the Anglo-Saxons as the representatives of sort of an original kind of freedom, and the Normans as these foreign oppressors.
Which is a revival of the myth of the Norman yoke promulgated by supporters of Parliament in the early 17th century in the lead up to the English Civil War. Looking for historical justification to oppose King Charles I's assertion of royal prerogatives to tax without the consent of Parliament and to imprison political opponents without trial, the champions of Parliament founded in Anglo-Saxon England. Edward the Confessor was reinvented as a constitutional monarch, and Magna Carta was reimagined as a revival of Anglo-Saxon principles of justice. In this conception of English history, the constitutional monarchy of England, with its system of common law that dictated justice for all, was plowed under by the ruthless greed of the Norman conquerors. Magna Carta was the first attempt to restore the ancient liberties of Englishmen, and these liberties were once again threatened by the Stuart monarchy. This, of course, is mostly historical myth invented because of political need. But when the myth becomes fact, print the myth. And that is what Sir Walter Scott did.
It's one of the more fascinating instances of people using history for their own political purposes.
Yes. And turning Magna Carta from a feudal document into a charter not of liberties, but a charter of liberty.
For which I think we should all be grateful to them. Because it actually did improve the lot of English people and by knock-on kind of effect, us as well.
That's true. That's true. By the 19th century, the Robin Hood legend had achieved the form that is familiar to us. The story takes place in the years 1193 to 1194. King Richard the Lionheart has been away on crusade. His return to England has been delayed by his capture by his Christian enemies, Duke Leopold of Austria and the Holy Roman Emperor Henry VI. Richard had named Bishop William Longchamp as regent in his absence. But Richard's discontented, disloyal, and ambitious brother John had driven Longchamp into exile and is now ruling England like a tyrant. John has driven the common people into poverty by levying unreasonably high taxes, ostensibly to raise ransom for Richard, but really to secure support for himself. This is where Robin of Locksley comes into the story. Robin is a nobleman, usually identified as the Earl of Huntingdon, one of the few Saxon families still holding a title and land under the rule of the oppressive Normans. Robin becomes an outlaw because of his loyalty to King Richard, his refusal to bow down to the treacherous Prince John, and his resistance to John's tyranny. Robin establishes a well-concealed robber's den in Sherwood Forest. There he assembles a band of honest outlaws, which includes Little John, Will Scarlet, Friar Tuck, and Allan a Dale. They rob rich, corrupt abbots and royal tax collectors and give the money to the poor. That is, to the common people impoverished by John's taxes. In other words, he returns to the people the tax money that they were forced to pay to John. There's a wonderful moment in the 1991 movie, Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, in which the Sheriff of Nottingham, played by Alan Rickman, realizes the implications of this.
What the devil?
It's a hot day, my friend, to burden your horse with such a heavy purse.
The Sheriff will hear of this!
I truly hope so.
Yeah! Ah. There you go, love. Buy yourself a new sow, Stephen.
God bless you, Fanny. And God bless Robin Hood. We reckon he's nicked 3 to 4 million in the last 5 months, sir.
All right, then, fine. Raise the bounty on his head. 25,000 crowns.
Begging your pardon, sir, it won't do no good. How much you raise it?
Really, scribe, and why is that?
Because, sire, the poor, you see, he gives them what he takes, so, well, sire, they love him.
Just a minute. Robin Hood steals money from my pocket, forcing me to hurt the public, and they love him for it?
Yes.
That's it, then. Cancel the kitchen scraps for lepers and orphans. No more merciful beheadings. And call off Christmas.
Prince John is usually in the background in the stories. Robin's primary antagonist, as in Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, are the corrupt sheriff of Nottingham and Guy of Gisborne, no longer the yeoman bounty hunter of the medieval ballads, but now a great Norman nobleman in love with the beautiful royal ward, Lady Marian Fitzwalter. Marian becomes a secret ally and eventually the lover of the noble outlaw Robin Hood. These are the building blocks for the numerous movie screenplays about Robin Hood. And they are legion. I've counted upward of 50 Robin Hood-themed movies produced between 1908 and 2022. Most are straightforward retellings of the familiar story, but included in the 50 are updates such as Frank Sinatra's truly odd gangster musical, Robin and the Seven Hoods, and films featuring Robin Hood's supposed son, the 1946 The Bandit of Sherwood Forest, and the 1950 Rogues of Sherwood, and Robin's daughter, the purposely misnamed 1958 Son of Robin Hood, and the 2001 Princess of Thieves. This list of movies include two parodies, Mel Brooks's funny, though uneven, Robin Hood, Men in Tights, which recycles some bits from Brooks's unsuccessful 1975 sitcom When Things Were Rotten, and the less funny, zany Adventures of Robin Hood, with the quintessential New Yorker George Segal zanily cast as Robin Hood. Both, surprisingly, respect the basic Robin Hood story, although they are constantly winking at the audience. At the other end are adult takes on the story, such as Richard Lester's 1976 Robin and Marian, with Sean Connery and Audrey Hepburn as older versions of the lovers. Unsurprisingly, most of these films are American or British-made, but 4 are Italian productions, 2 Russian, another 2 Indian, 1 German, and 1 Brazilian. There have been also 8 American and British-made television series and innumerable Robin Hood episodes on TV shows ranging from Doctor Who and Star Trek The Next Generation to The Muppets Show. Robin Hood has been an especially popular character in cartoons, and there have been several animated features, most notably Walt Disney's 1973 Robin Hood. The appeal of a charming noble rogue who robs the rich to give to the poor and fights tyranny against overwhelming odds seems to be universal. So before we talk about the movies, let's talk a little bit about our own introductions to Robin Hood. I was introduced to Robin Hood by the Howard Pyle Merry Adventures of Robin Hood. Howard Pyle wrote this in 1883. It's heavily illustrated. I then remember later having another children's Robin Hood by a guy named Cheswick that was illustrated by N.C. Wyeth, and I remember the illustrations. I don't remember much about the book.
Well, my introduction was cinematic, so the first thing that I remember seeing was the Disney Robin Hood.
Which I like.
Which came out in 1973. That is still, I think, one of the best Robin Hood movies ever made.
What's depressing is you're indicating how much older I am than you are. 1973, yes, the year I graduated from college.
Well, I should throw in, though, that my introduction to the Errol Flynn Robin Hood from 1938 came from an English medieval history class that I took in high school.
Really?
Yes. So one of the things that that we did as a sort of an extra activity was they showed that film for us.
Wow.
And so I watched Errol Flynn, having just studied the period that the film actually depicts.
Yes. Let's talk about the film. There are just too many Robin Hood movies and television shows to talk about all of them, even if Jenny and I between us had managed to sample all of them. And honestly, we didn't even come close. So we're going to just simply talk about a few of the Robin Hood films that we have recently seen. And what I think we'll do is we will do them from the best to the worst. Let me start by saying that I don't think there are any good Robin Hood films historically, because these movies are set either while John ruled England in his brother Richard the Lionheart's absence on Crusade, or, in a few cases, during John's reign. And as we heard in the previous episode, all the possible candidates for a historical Robin Hood come from a later period, either from the reign of John's son Henry III or John's great-grandson Edward II. The idea of an outlawed noble taking to the greenwood to lead a band of robbers in opposition to the tyranny of Prince John and his henchman, the Sheriff of Nottingham, has no historical basis at all.
No, and I don't think we would actually enjoy a filmed version of the real medieval Robin Hood tales.
No, probably not. And we wouldn't enjoy a movie which was about the historical Robin Hood fugitive.
No, because in fact he's not really that compelling or admirable a character as far as we can tell.
No. So the Robin Hood movies, what we can do is we can rank them on the basis of just how enjoyable they are, and we can also consider them on the basis of how faithful they are to the history of the period in which they are set, the late 12th century, and to the historical figures who appear in them, Prince John, King Richard, and others. So let's start with what you think is the best Robin Hood movie, and I'll tell you what I think is the best Robin Hood movie.
Well, for me, it's hands down Errol Flynn, 1938.
I have to agree with you. So why do you think this is the best of the Robin Hood films?
I think this is the most complete film in terms of all of the elements that you want in a movie. It has a coherent plot.
Yes.
It has appealing protagonists. It has cringeworthy but really impressive villains. It is beautifully shot. It has a wonderful score. It's incredibly watchable. And one scholar said that this is one of the only films from the 1930s that is just presented on television just as a movie, as opposed to being some sort of historical cinematic artifact.
It is. And I love it because, for one thing, the cast is about as good as you can get. Errol Flynn is the perfect Robin Hood, charmingly insouciant but eloquent and impassioned in his defense of justice. Athletic, not to mention stunningly handsome. Olivia de Havilland is equally beautiful and intrepid as Lady Marian. You can't find a better Little John than Alan Hale Sr., who played it three times, in 1922, 1938, and then again in 1950. Basil Rathbone, who went on to become an iconic Sherlock Holmes in a series of films between 1939 and 1946, makes a perfect Guy of Gisborne. And Claude Rains is Prince John.
He's fantastic.
When I think of Prince John now, I think of Claude Rains. Everybody in that film is perfect. Warner Brothers loaded the film with their best character actors, Patrick Knowles as a gentlemanly Will Scarlet, and Eugene Pallett as a grumpy, ever-hungry, but lovable Friar Tuck. The duo of Herbert Munden as Much and Una O'Connor as Lady Marian's nursemaid, Bess, provide comic relief, as does, oddly enough, Melville Cooper as the cowardly, ineffectual, and braggart Sheriff of Nottingham. This is one version of the story where Guy of Gisborne and not the sheriff is the main antagonist. At the end of the film, in fact, Guy of Gisborne and Robin have one of the best duel scenes in all of movies. The only one that I think is better than that is the climactic duel scene between Michael York as D'Artagnan and Christopher Lee as de Rochefort in Richard Lester's The Four Musketeers. Credit also goes to its director, Michael Curtiz, who had previously directed Errol Flynn and Olivia de Havilland in Captain Blood and excelled in fast-paced swashbucklers. The film is beautifully shot in the three-strip Technicolor process, the first time that this process was used by Warner Brothers. The Academy Award-winning musical score.
Eric Korngold.
Yes, by the Austrian composer and conductor Erich Korngold, is simply glorious. Korngold had also composed the music for Captain Blood, but was reluctant to score another swashbuckler. He was finally persuaded not by Warner Brothers, but by Hitler, as the Jewish Korngold became increasingly aware of the growing Nazi threat to Austria. The Adventures of Robin Hood was the most expensive film that Warner Brothers had made up to this point, costing $2 million, and it shows. But the cost was justified by the box office receipts. The Adventures of Robin Hood ended up as the highest-grossing film of 1938 and was nominated, though it didn't win, Academy Award for Best Picture. The success of the movie is also due to an outstanding screenplay by Seton I. Miller and Norman Reilly Maine. The dialogue is marked with clever barbs and witty exchanges, balanced by impassioned pronouncements, exemplified by Robin's give-and-take with Prince John after Robin crashes a banquet at Nottingham Castle, carrying on his back an illegally killed deer.
By my faith, but you're a bold rascal. Robin, I like you.
I'm gratified, Your Highness. I don't think Gisborne shares that sentiment, however.
You'll excuse me, Your Highness.
Sit down, my dear. He'll not harm you. Sir Robin, this is the Lady Marian Fitzwalter.
I hope my lady had a pleasant journey from London.
What you hope can hardly be important.
What a pity her manners don't match her looks, Your Highness.
You hear that, gentlemen? Here's poor Gisborne so in love with Marian, he daren't say boo to her. And this saucy fellow gives her better than she sends. My lords and ladies, I would like to present to you Sir Robin of Locksley.
I'm deeply honored, Your Highness.
Have you had meat?
None but what I brought.
Well, sit down then. Sit down there, opposite me. Get up, Sir Ivor, and give him your place.
Your Highness.
Get up, Sir Knight. Bring Sir Robin food. At once, do you hear? Such impudence must support a mighty appetite.
True enough, Your Highness. We Saxons have little to fatten on by the time your tax gatherers are through.
So you think you're overtaxed, eh?
Overtaxed, overworked, and paid off with a knife, a club, or a rope.
Why, you speak treason.
Fluently.
Miller and Maine drew from both the medieval ballads and the Elizabethan additions to the story, probably by way of Paul Creswick's popular retelling of the tales, Robin Hood, published in 1917. Robin's activities in the movie take place in Sherwood Forest rather than Barnsdale Forest, as in the medieval ballads, and during the reign of Richard the Lionheart, while the king was absent from England on crusade, rather than the reign of one of the three King Edwards, as in the medieval jest of Robin Hood. The dating of Robin Hood to the early 1190s was first suggested by the Scottish historian John Major in 1521 and had become canonical by the 18th century as England's most famous medieval outlaw and most famous king became inextricably bound together. The historical context for the Adventures of Robin Hood is Prince John's seizure of the regency from Richard's chosen man, Bishop William de Longchamp. Under the pretext of raising ransom for his brother, John is oppressively taxing the Saxon peasants to enrich himself. The character of Lady Marian Fitzwalter comes from Anthony Mundy's play of 1598, The Downfall of Robert, Earl of Huntingdon. Mundy identified the Maid Marian of the May festivities with a historical figure, Matilda, daughter of the Baron Robert Fitzwalter. Robert Fitzwalter was one of the leaders of the baronial revolt against John in 1215, culminated in the issuance of Magna Carta. Implicated in a plot to assassinate John in 1212, he attributed his hatred of the king to John's attempt to seduce his daughter Matilda. Whether John, whose lechery is a leitmotif in the hostile chronicles, actually did this or not, the story of the attempted seduction became a subject of ballads in the later Middle Ages. According to Mundy, Matilda Fitzwalter changed her name to Marian when she married Robin Hood. This identification of Maid Marian caught on, and she appears as Lady Marian Fitzwalter in 19th and early 20th century popular treatments of the Robin Hood story, and from there it made its way into the movies. Robin Hood himself, in The Adventures of Robin Hood, is a Saxon noble, though not Earl of Huntingdon. He is Sir Robin of Locksley at the beginning of the movie, and is elevated by King Richard to be Baron of Locksley and Earl of Sherwood at the film's end. A card in the opening credits claims that the movie is based on, quote, the ancient Robin Hood legends, end quote. Ancient, no, but The Adventures of Robin Hood does draw heavily upon the late medieval ballads. It was from these ballads that Miller and Mayne took the stories of Robin's quarterstaff fight with Little John on a log bridge spanning a shallow creek, his sword fight with Friar Tuck, the archery contest held by the Sheriff of Nottingham to trap the disguised Robin Hood, and Robin Hood's encounter in the forest with the king and his retinue disguised as monks. Combined together, all of these elements made a fast-moving, first-rate adventure film filled with derring-do and romance. The Adventures of Robin Hood is also a period piece. Arguably, it has less to do with the 12th century than it does with Depression-era America.
Without a doubt. I mean, really, all movies are. But this really does give us a 1930s Robin Hood.
It does. The Adventures of Robin Hood has a scene that is just perfect for Depression-era America. Robin and his band have just ambushed a company of Normans escorting the tax money to Prince John. In charge of the Normans are Sir Guy of Gisborne and the Sheriff of Nottingham, and accompanying them is Lady Marian. As in the medieval jest of Robin Hood, Robin, quote unquote, invites Sir Guy and the captured Normans to feast with him. Unlike in the ballad, Sir Guy and the sheriff are humiliated by Robin by having them stripped of their fine clothes. Robin, however, treats Lady Marian with the greatest courtesy, only to have her respond snottily. She points at the gold and silver spread out at the table.
Cutthroats intend to send this treasure to Richard. You wouldn't dream of keeping it yourselves.
Friends! What shall we do with this treasure? Divide it amongst ourselves?
Hold it for Richard!
It belongs to the king!
Convinced?
I may have been hasty, but why you, a knight, should live here like an animal in the forest, robbing, killing, outlaw?
You really interested in learning why I turned outlaw? Or are you afraid of the truth? Or of me, perhaps?
I'm afraid of nothing, least of all of you.
Good. Then come with me.
Robin then takes Marian to another part of the forest. There we see poverty-stricken and beaten villagers gratefully partaking, not of venison and wine like the merry men, but of stew and bread. They bless Robin. Marian is shocked to see the suffering of the people at the hands of her fellow Normans, but struggles to understand why Robin feels compelled to do something about it.
You're a strange man.
Strange? Because I can feel for beaten, helpless people?
No, you're strange because you want to do something about it. You're willing to defy Sir Guy, even Prince John himself, to risk your own life. And one of those men was a Norman.
Norman or Saxon? What's that matter? It's injustice I hate, not the Normans.
But it's lost you your rank, your lands. It's made you a hunted outlaw when you might have lived in comfort and security. What's your reward for all this?
Reward? I just don't understand, Claire.
I'm sorry. I do begin to see. A little now.
You do, then?
that's reward enough.
In terms of the film's narrative, this is the beginning of the romance between Robin and Marion and the transformation of Marion into a supporter of the cause. But what I see here is Robin operating a Depression-era soup kitchen going on where they're feeding the locals.
It's really incredible. I mean, it's Robin Hood meets John Steinbeck.
Yes, it is. And Marion is so impressed. She had never realized it was suffering before. And that Robin is taking care of the poor the way that a king ought to have taken care of the poor.
So Marion actually becomes a proxy for the audience who is being slowly enlightened about the social situation in the England being depicted in the film.
And maybe also 1938 America. And what's also nice about it is that there's a certain American egalitarianism about it, because Robin is a noble, but he's also a Saxon. He's a Saxon noble.
So we have this continuity with the 19th century view of Robin Hood as a partisan for the Saxon cause against the Norman oppressor.
And Richard, the absent king, when he returns, will be able to unite all of his subjects.
Because Robin Hood schools him.
Exactly. I can just imagine Robin explaining to good King Richard upon his return that what England needs now is a new deal. It's a great film, and it captures the romantic vision of the Middle Ages.
And I will give it huge props for little details that are, in fact, historically accurate about the period that is being depicted, so yeah. The 1190s. They actually get the amount of Richard's ransom correct.
That is good. Also, it's not drab. So many medieval movies looks like the entire Middle Ages was overcast and that there were no decorations anywhere.
One of the things that's accurate in the film is the colors that Robin Hood and Will Scarlet wear. Now, they were probably not tights like they are in the film, but they would have worn green and scarlet. And that's something that actually comes from the medieval ballads, that there was a distribution of these bright, colorful clothes. Because that was what you did to show prosperity.
Yes.
In the Middle Ages was to give brightly colored clothing because that was a sign of your wealth. And so the fact that they dressed in green and scarlet, they were not trying to blend into the forest. This was not medieval camo.
Yes.
This was a way of kind of flaunting it.
Also showing off technicolor.
Very much so.
So my second favorite is one that you haven't seen, and that is the 1922 Robin Hood with Douglas Fairbanks. This is one of the great silent films. It was directed by Alan Dwan, with the screenplay credited to Douglas Fairbanks, who headed a team of writers. If Errol Flynn was the most charming and handsome Robin Hood, Fairbanks is, without a doubt, the most energetic. The movie includes Wallace Beery as a burly, boisterous, and surprisingly, for a silent film, a really loud Richard the Lionheart, to judge from the film's intertitles, Enid Bennett as the beautiful and demure Lady Marion Fitzwalter, Sam DeGrasse, whom I had never seen before, as an appropriately sullen, lecherous, and villainous Prince John, Paul Dickey as an ineffectual Guy of Gisborne, and Alan Hale as Little John. Alan Hale, perhaps best known to my generation as the father of Alan Hale Jr., the skipper of the TV show Gilligan's Island, was to play Little John again in 1938, a truly wonderful performance, and in 1950 in Rogues of Sherwood, alongside John Derrick as Robin Hood's son, in a less impressive performance as an older Little John, still capable of hurling people around, clearly assisted by movie magic. The movie begins with Robin, identified as the Earl of Huntingdon, defeating his rival Guy of Gisborne in a joust in front of the king. Huntingdon jousts as King Richard's champion, and Gisborne as Richard's sullen brother John's. Robin, of course, wins the joust, despite Gisborne's attempt to cheat, and is rewarded with a crown from the tournament's goddess of beauty, Lady Marion Fitzwalter, the object of Gisborne's lust. Robin is an intrepid hero with one vulnerability. He is shy when it comes to women, and although he secretly loves Marion, he can hardly bring himself to approach her. The tournament is held to celebrate Richard's imminent departure upon crusade. On the evening before the king and his knights are to set forth, the court parties. The knights pair off with the damsels of the court, all except for Robin, the knight most likely to be the wallflower at an orgy. Richard will hear nothing of this and orders Robin to find a lady for a goodbye kiss. When Robin demurs, Richard orders all the ladies of the court, and he seems to have gathered every starlet then working in Hollywood, to mob the shy Robin. Robin, however, is distracted when he sees Lady Marian fleeing up a staircase with a drunk and lecherous Prince John in pursuit. He runs after them, preserves Marian's virtue, and Marian, who obviously has a thing for Robin, lures him into a kiss. While on crusade, Robin receives a letter from Marian about Prince John's tyranny and his intention to seize the throne in Richard's absence. Robin tells Richard and asks leave to return to England, but Richard, disbelieving him and poisoned by Guy of Gisborne's intimations that Robin is a coward, refuses. More loyal to Richard than obedient, Robin determines to disobey the king's order, but is ambushed by Guy of Gisborne. An angry Richard accuses Robin of cowardice, strips him of his title and lands, and orders that he be imprisoned as a deserter. Robin, of course, makes a daring acrobatic escape and returns to England to find himself outlawed and to learn that Lady Marian has died. Spoiler alert, she hasn't. He takes the name Robin Hood, gathers together a large and very merry outlaw band in Sherwood Forest that robs from the rich to give to the poor, and performs more acrobatic feats of daring do to foil the plans of John and his henchmen, the wicked Sheriff of Nottingham. The climax of the film has Robin learning that Marian is alive and a prisoner of Prince John. He performs a daring rescue just in time. Marian, threatened by Gisborne, intent upon rape, throws herself from the window only to be caught by Robin as he climbs the wall. Robin hoists Marian up and tangles with a very surprised Gisborne. Robin, of course, wins and kills the villainous Gisborne, though curiously not in a sword duel, but by breaking his back against a pillar. Before they can escape, hordes of John's knights break into the chamber. Robin gives Marian a knife to save her honor, just in case, and plans to fight to the death until he hears three blows of a forest horn, signaling that his merry men are on their way, having defeated the knights that John had dispatched to capture them. Now confident that he and Marian will be rescued, Robin surrenders. Unknown to Robin, though, is that a mysterious knight whose identity is concealed by his helmet has joined up with the robber band. Just as Robin is about to be executed by Prince John by a firing squad of crossbowmen, and Lady Marian is about to stab herself, Robin is rescued by his merry men. The mysterious knight protects Robin from the crossbow bolts with his shield and is revealed to be none other than, spoiler alert, good King Richard. The merry men fight and defeat John's troops, and Richard himself picks John up by the scruff of his neck and kicks him and the Sheriff of Nottingham out of the castle with the drawbridge pulled up behind them. The merry men make merry. Richard asks Robin's forgiveness for mistrusting him and gives him permission to marry Lady Marian. The merry men again make merry. Apparently they came prepared for victory because they are all armed with mugs filled with beer. At the marriage feast, Robin and Marian slip away to a private chamber. Richard, noticing the absence of Robin, calls out for Huntington. He shouts so loudly that it knocks a bunch of the merry men off of the wall. But Robin and Marian ignore him and ignore his banging at their chamber door as the movie ends. The movie was produced by Douglas Fairbanks for the company he founded with his wife Mary Pickford and Charlie Chaplin, United Artists. No expense was spared. Fairbanks hired as his production designer for the castle and the 12th century village the architect Frank Lloyd Wright. Production costs came to nearly $1 million. An unheard of sum for the silent era, and made back almost three times that much. It was the biggest hit of 1922. This is a silent film with all the virtues and weaknesses of that genre. The acting is broad. Douglas Fairbanks, who in 1922 was so big a star that the movie was released with the title Douglas Fairbanks in Robin Hood, performs his own impressive acrobatic stunts. To underscore that Robin's band is truly merry, The director, Alan Juan, has them leap about, waving their arms. At one point, I thought they were about to burst into a Busby Berkeley musical number.
Well, that's something that gets parodied later in Robin Hood Men in Tights.
Yeah, but it might be funnier in the 1922 movie. Still, for those who like silent films, such as my daughter Rebecca, this movie is a real joy. It has 100% rating on Rotten Tomatoes. Not as good as Errol Flynn, but then again, I'm going to argue that nobody is good as Errol Flynn. You want to talk about the Disney one?
Well, the Disney one is just fantastic. Robin Hood is a fox. Maid Marian is a vixen.
That makes sense.
And we replace the character of Sir Guy of Gisborne with Sir Hiss, who is a snake. A snake, right. And it is, I mean, I won't say too much more about it, except to say that many people regard it as one of the finest Disney animated films ever made.
Hmm.
And I would definitely agree. It has a wonderful score, wonderful songs.
Though a lot more Disney than medieval.
Robin Hood and Little John walking through the forest, laughing back and forth at what the other has to say. Reminiscing this and that and having such a good time. Oodle-lolly, golly, what a day.
And it's incredibly watchable. It really is watchable. You can watch it even as an adult.
I also like that there is a medieval genre of animal fables. Reynard the Fox.
Oh, They chose to depict Robin Hood as a fox for that very reason. So it really does feed right into something that is authentically medieval.
The lion is the king of beasts in medieval fabliau, and in the film, Prince John is represented as scrawny and King Richard as a majestic lion. As in the medieval animal tales, the enemy of the wily fox, in this instance, the Sheriff of Nottingham, is a wolf. I read that there was debate whether Marian, as a relative of Richard, should also be a lion, but I guess the taboo of animal miscegenation led the animators to draw her as a vixen instead. I'm not as enamored with Disney's Robin Hood as you are, maybe because I first saw it at a less impressionable age, but I'll concede that it's a good and surprisingly faithful introduction to the Robin Hood legend. I think we can be agreed that another good Robin Hood film, although it's kind of an eccentric one, is Robin and Marian.
It would be next on my list, in fact.
And that was 1976. Sean Connery, who was to play King Richard 15 years later in Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, is an aging and disillusioned Robin Hood. As the movie begins, Robin and Little John are helping King Richard besiege a castle. They have served Richard for many years, both on crusade and now in his wars in France. Richard wants the castle because of a rumor that within it lies a golden statue. When Robin learns that the castle, which is filled with helpless women and children, is defended only by an elderly one-eyed crossbowman, and that the statue is made of stone, he and Little John refuse Richard's order. An angry Richard has them seized and tells them that they will be executed. As Richard prepares to storm the castle, he is shot in the shoulder by the old man. The castle is taken and its helpless inhabitants, except for the bowmen, spared by Richard on a whim, are massacred. A mortally wounded Richard offers Robin his life if he begs for mercy. Robin refuses, and Richard draws his sword to strike him down. But Richard then collapses. Robin, loyal to the end, helps Richard up, and the king, touched by Robin's loyalty, forgives him and Little John. Robin and Little John return to England, where he meets up with Will Scarlet and Friar Tuck and learns that he has become a legend. He seeks out Marian, who has in his absence become an abbess. He learns that King John has ordered the Sheriff of Nottingham to seize her and her nuns. They are to be expelled from England due to the king's quarrel with the church. Robin, seeing a chance to add to his legend, decides to defy both the sheriff and Marian, who is willing to abide by King John's order. Despite her vows as a nun and a frustration with Robin's addiction to impractical heroics, Marian rekindles her romance with Robin. Meanwhile, Robin gathers a new band of men to fight the sheriff. In this version of the story, the sheriff, played by a very good Robert Shaw, is a reluctant and even admirable adversary. He admires Robin's idealism, but he is a royal official doing his job. The main villain is the arrogant Doberman Sir Ranulph. The movie climaxes in a single combat duel between Robin and the sheriff, with the badly wounded Robin managing to kill the sheriff. The trial by combat solves nothing, and Sir Ranulph orders his soldiers to attack. Robin's men, untrained in war, are slaughtered, though Ranulph is killed by Little John. Major, at this point I should give a major spoiler alert. Robin asks to be taken to Marion, who is a physician. Knowing that Robin's days of glories have passed, Marion prepares a poison that she administers to Robin and then drinks herself. Robin, knowing that he's been poisoned, calls to Little John, but Robin comes to realize that Marion has done this out of love and accepts it. When John breaks into the chamber, Marion is dead, Robin is dying, and Robin asks Little John to hand him his bow, and for the last time Robin shoots. Wherever the arrow lands, he tells John, is where John should bury him and Marion together. And that's how the movie ends. Robin and Marion has a great director, Richard Lester, and a great cast. Sean Connery and Audrey Hepburn have real chemistry and are believable as the aging lovers who know each other perhaps too well. The 1960s and 1970s saw a number of revisionist westerns that sought to subvert that mythos. Robin and Marion does to the medieval movie what McCabe and Mrs. Miller did to the Western. It does this not by turning Robin into a villain, but by contrasting his impractical and ultimately selfish heroism with Marion's and the sheriff's pragmatism. The movie is not about how Robin became a legend, but about how Robin died.
Which is an actual medieval ballad.
Yes.
So it is based on some of the details of the original story, although they change the abbess in the story is just a villain, but in this film she turns into somebody who poisons Robin Hood at the end because he needs to go out in a blaze of glory.
Yes, yes, and so you have an unhappy happy ending.
You do. I mean, you have sort of a poetic justice, and it even preserves the story, the medieval story about the Robin Hood shooting an arrow.
Yes.
And where the arrow lands is where he will be buried. And they have that in the film as well.
And it has Nicole Williamson as Little John. And I always liked Nicole Williamson.
He's fantastic in this part. And it's a wonderful depiction of that complicated brotherly relationship between Robin Hood and Little
John.
Yeah,
that medieval bromance.
But I also have to say that one of my absolute favorite things in that film is the depiction of the sheriff, Robert Shaw.
Yeah.
He's great in that film. He's really great. It's a subtle performance because there's a way in which Robert Shaw, the sheriff, doesn't want to have
yes.
to kill Robin Hood.
Yeah.
He is somebody who admires Robin Hood on a certain level and is forced by the position that he finds himself in to be his enemy.
It's subtle. It's really well done. And if we're going now to shift from subtle to not so subtle, and also from, I think, films that I would say are really good films, the films that may not be quite as good, but are still entertaining. Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, which features Alan Rickman as the Sheriff of Nottingham, is probably the most scene-stealing, scenery-chewing presentation of the Sheriff of Nottingham in any movie.
That, I think, is very true. And you will find critical opinion on his performance to be divided. There are many who are alienated by the over-the-top nature of it.
When he cancels Christmas?
He is, yes. But I would have to say that I am in the camp of people who are glad that he just went for it.
He did go for it.
He dialed it to 11.
And what it contrasts with is the laid-back Kevin Costner version of Robin Hood.
Very laid-back.
Very laid-back. And we have to be grateful that Kevin Costner did not try to put on an English accent.
He really pretty much didn't. And I have to say that I was pleasantly surprised by how little that bothered me in the end.
It also gives us a Morgan Freeman as Azim, the Moor, who is saved by Robin in the beginning and then has to repay this by saving Robin's life.
Right. So you get this outsider view of the Merry Men from this person who comes from outside of Christian culture, who is thus given the ability to comment on what he experiences. For us, the audience in the 20th century at that point.
Yes.
Which, you know, plays a very useful sort of narrative role.
And what I really liked in this film was Maid Marian, Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio.
She is really good in that film.
Yeah. She plays well against Kevin Costner. And it's a Maid Marian who's more of an agent than just simply an object.
Yes. And so we get an advance on even what we had with Olivia de Havilland in the 1938 film, where she does have agency, but she is still a little bit of a buttoned-up princess.
Yes.
And Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio is a little bit more relaxed.
Yeah. In contrast to Enid Bennett as Maid Marian in the 1922 Douglas Fairbanks in Robin Hood, Bennett later commented that it was one of the easiest roles she ever had to play because all she had to do was walk around and look regal. She is the object of Robin's love, and she is just simply there because she's beautiful.
Whereas as we go deeper into the late 20th century and into the 21st century, Marian becomes somebody who picks up a dagger and she's going to fight.
Yes, and she's going to wear armor.
Which is important to point out actually has a basis in the 17th century ballads of Robin Hood, in which Marian actually cross-dresses and fights a duel with Robin Hood in disguise. And that's kind of a courting ritual for them. And sort of, you could, at the end, they say basically sort of, you know, spitting on their hands and shake on it. And basically Robin Hood has discovered Maid Marian as his equal, and they're going to have a fantastic partnership. And it's hard to believe that that actually comes from the 17th century, but it does.
And to be honest, this is the first I've ever heard about that medieval story. You know, what's kind of nice about the Robin Hood movies and the stories is that Robin meets so many of his band by fighting with them, by challenging them, and he loses.
He loses
to Little John, and instead of being angry and coming to get revenge, he invites him to join him in his band.
Well, that's the thing about Robin Hood, is you mentioned earlier the courtesy.
Yes.
That he has. He is not prickly. He is not proud. He's basically interested in things working out the best. And the best situation is when you have the best men around you.
The only thing that he is also is he's mischievous.
He is mischievous.
So he will do things that really aren't very sensible, like participate in an archery competition because he just wants to win it.
And he's not really very good at disguising himself, is he?
No, he isn't. No, he really isn't. He's always going to be exposed.
Yes.
And in Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, the Kevin Costner version, we have, as a special guest star, Sean Connery playing Richard. He's not listed in the credits.
This is a little bit of a wink, wink, nudge, nudge at the audience.
It is. And the reason why he was not listed in the credits was because if Sean Connery's name appeared in the credits, everybody would be waiting for him to appear.
Right. And I'm sure it would have also been difficult to know where to put him.
Yes. It only took him a day of filming, and he got paid an outrageous sum for it. So.
And it was worth it.
It was. It was. It's actually not a bad film. It's terrible history, but it's not a bad film.
I would have to say that I was not expecting to like it as much as I did.
Now, the movie that I think would raise a lot of disagreements is the 2010 Robin Hood starring Russell Crowe. A spoiler alert. You have to wait till the very end of the movie for the story to begin.
I wonder whether they were hoping there'd be a sequel.
I think they had to be. Why else do you have to wait for the entire damn film for him to be outlawed? He's not with a band of merry men. It's the prequel.
It's a very, very, very long backstory.
A very long backstory. But it's one of the few times that you actually have a real backstory for Robin. It's not, and you don't have it in any of the medieval stories. Robin just appears.
The thing that's interesting, though, is that the backstory is really completely invented.
It's completely invented.
The historical context for it is utterly different from what we see in the other modern versions.
So why don't you tell just a little bit about what the backstory is?
So the backstory for the 2010 version is that Robin Hood is coming back from the Crusade, and he is in France on the way back from the Crusade, and there are all sorts of machinations at court.
And Richard has died.
Richard has died, so it's kind of a race to get back to England, and there is a plot between a member of King John's inner circle and King Philip Augustus of France.
Godfrey, the evil Godfrey, played by Mark Strong.
And he is a very evil guy.
He's a very evil guy. He speaks French, you know.
He speaks French very well, in fact.
Yes, he does.
And so he is plotting to subvert the crown of England. And so he causes there to be an ambush of the actual son of the Baron of Locksley. Right?
Yes. He believes that he's ambushing Richard, not knowing that Richard has already died during the siege of Chalus. And instead, he ambushes the party which is bringing Richard's crown back to England and to announce the death of Richard.
Right. So what happens after this ambush is that the Russell Crowe character ends up coming upon this situation, kills the rest of the ambushers, takes the crown, and takes on the identity of the original messenger.
Locksley.
And so basically what we're getting from the beginning is Robin Hood as an operator.
We also know two things about him. One is he's a really good professional archer.
Yes.
As are his two companions, Little John and Will Scarlet. And we also know he's honest, because King Richard, in a moment taken straight out of Shakespeare's Henry V, goes wandering through his camp in disguise in the beginning to find what the soldiers really think about him. And he finds Robin, and Robin is honest with him. And he asks Robin a question that Robin doesn't want to answer. Will I gain favor in heaven for my crusade? Robin pauses, and Robin finally, almost unwillingly, says, "No, sire." Richard is shocked. "Why do you say that?" He says, "Because of the massacre at Acre. I remember standing above a woman as she begged me, and the order to kill. I don't see how God could ever forgive that." And Richard declares him to be an honest and naive man, and promptly has Robin and Little John put in stocks. Historically, I could understand why Richard might have been upset. According to the sources, Richard did order the beheading of about 2,700 Muslim prisoners of war at Acre when Saladin was late with the agreed-upon ransom. But these were fighting men, not women or children. That is horrendous enough in itself, but it was not a massacre of women and children as portrayed in this film.
Well, one of the things that's so interesting about that moment is that we are immediately, as the audience, put on Robin's side, because the filmmakers are playing on our reaction to the Crusades.
Yes.
So the Crusades have changed roles in the Robin Hood story between the early 20th century and now, in terms of what the audience is expected to think about them. So at the period of the 1930s Robin Hood, Richard is coming back from the Crusade, and the Crusade is, if anything, a positive thing.
Very.
Right. But by the end of the 20th century, the Crusade is becoming a negative thing, and very decidedly in this case. So we already know something about Robin Hood, which is that he disapproves of the massacre at Acre. And the same thing was made clear about Robin in Robin and Marian as well.
Yes.
And also has Robin refusing to take part in what is clearly a repeat of the massacre at Acre. And in that scene, we come upon this castle that's being besieged in France, and it looks like it's the Middle East.
Yes.
Right? So it's very obviously, the mise-en-scène is very much, this is really the continuation of the Crusades,
yes,
and Richard is behaving in the same brutal way.
I suspect that screenplay writer Brian Helgeland and director Ridley Scott consciously were echoing the opening scene of Robin and Marian, Both films, after all, begin with Richard's death while besieging the castle of Chaluz, and both films have Richard order the arrest of Robin and Little John because Robin reproaches him for ordering or having ordered the slaughter of helpless women and children. This is not part of either the medieval or the 19th century stories about Robin Hood. This is cinema drawing upon cinema. I'd also note that Ridley Scott was the director and creative force behind the 2005 film Kingdom of Heaven, which is a thoroughly negative portrayal of the Crusades.
So if we get back to the 2010 Robin Hood, we are already identifying with Robin Hood as the hero who has the right values, the right 21st century values.
And Richard also has ceased to be the paragon of virtue and kingliness.
Yes, and that's one reason why the 2010 film is so interesting, because the chronological context has been dislocated. So the original stories we see in Errol Flynn take place in 1194, basically,
yes,
when Richard returns to England after being ransomed. But the 2010 Robin Hood takes place after Richard's death, because we now need to have Richard dead because we no longer can admire him.
Yes. All of these stories also have to make the Third Crusade last a lot longer than it did in order to justify the need to have Robin rescue England from the oppression of John. In this case, supposedly, Robin Longstride, or Robin Hood, has been gone for 10 years on crusade. And the reality is that Richard the Lionheart left England in 1190, crusaded in 1191 and 1192, got captured on his way back, and was held in captivity by the Holy Roman Emperor until 1194, when he was ransomed back. In all, he's gone for 4 years. In all.
Right. Well, he then comes back to England
briefly,
but then he doesn't go back to the Middle East. He goes to France, where he stays for the rest of his reign until he dies there.
Fighting.
But that's too complicated for the modern audience.
It's too complicated. And the thing about this particular Robin Hood is that it simplifies the history so that we can have a story which is compressed in time and a story that will include, strangely enough, Magna Carta.
This was the biggest surprise for me of this film, that we actually got all the way through John's reign when we really don't see any time passing at all. So he becomes king in 1199. We get all the way to 1215. And John hasn't aged a day.
Well, only a couple of months have passed from this.
Basically.
And it turns out that, and this is one of the things that I never knew from all the study of history that I've done, is that Magna Carta was actually written by a stonemason who's the father of Robin Hood.
Right, absolutely, because it was clearly in the air.
Yes.
One of the things that's so interesting is the way in which Magna Carta becomes in this film something that rose from the bottom up.
Yes.
Which is so completely different from how Magna Carta actually went down. Magna Carta was a baronial document that got a few things added onto it as different people showed up at the table to try to get what they were getting.
And it's presented in here as being the founding document of liberty. Not liberties, but liberty. This, in fact, echoes an earlier film. A terrible, terrible film. Which, at least I think, a terrible film, called Rogues of Sherwood, which starred John Derrick, Bo Derrick's husband, as Robin Hood's son, Robin of Huntingdon. It takes place in the reign of King John, and King John has become tyrannical. His tyranny is shown by the fact that he has started to tax again. You see, King Richard had relieved all of England from taxation.
The Saladin tithe?
Don't worry about it. Not only that, but he had introduced democracy into England.
That would have been something to see.
And John has overturned all of this. And so, in this movie, Robin Jr. and an aging band of merry men are going to unite with the northern barons in order to impose upon John a document that will restore the democratic values that Richard had put into place.
Well, considering that most historians today would regard Magna Carta as a reaction to all Angevin rule dating back to the reign of Henry II, I wouldn't think we could sustain that argument.
Getting back once more to the 2010 Ridley Scott Robin Hood, I'd give a shout out to Cate Blanchett as Marion.
She's fantastic.
Oscar Isaac makes a really good Prince John. He's weaselly.
I think he's very good. And I think the way that he, at the very end of the film, basically renounces Magna Carta actually does...
Yes.
Does depict what really happens.
Yes.
Not in, you know, not in completely every detail, but it is somewhat accurate. They even do have the French invasion of England, even though they get a lot of the details of that wrong.
And it looks like Saving Private Ryan in reverse.
They do look like landing vehicles from Normandy.
Because you see the arrows descending into the water with the bodies in the water. Yeah, it's
that part is ridiculous.
It is. And you also have William Marshall.
Well, he's a fascinating character. Because he actually does really, I think, in the film, play the sort of role that William Marshall played in life, which was to try as far as he could to curb the worst excesses of whoever his overlord was at the time.
And he tries. He's not willing to abandon John, even though John dismisses him from the service.
He still carries on in the service of the realm, behind the scenes, attempting to subvert the plot that is being carried out.
Yeah, and when John renounces Magna Carta and then outlaws Robin, who has saved his ass, and outlaws him for no real good reason, just simply seems like a whim, I thought to myself, wait a minute. And then I thought to myself, yeah, John would have done that.
Oh, John would have absolutely done that. You know, Arbitrary was his middle name.
Yeah, it was. My problem with the film is that it's like Ridley Scott's Kingdom of Heaven and Gladiator. It's a film that on the surface looks like it's historical, and you're supposed to take it seriously. It's not fun the way that The Adventures of Robin Hood with Errol Flynn is fun. There's a seriousness that's built into the film, and it's the type of thing that misleads people, an audience, into believing that they're actually learning something.
Yes, there are lots and lots of historical howlers in this film.
Lots of them. The only thing really good historically about the film, I think, are the costumes.
They are pretty good.
Now, if we're looking at a film that's fun, that has no historical value, Robin Hood, Men in Tights.
I have to say I have conflicted feelings about Men in Tights because I laughed aloud many, many times watching this film. At the same time, it is so over the top. What I would say is if you like this sort of thing, this is the sort of thing you like.
Yes. This is a film in which the returning Richard, played by Patrick Stewart, chastises John by announcing that from this moment on, all of the men's rooms, all of the loos in Britain are going to be called John's.
There is a lot of toilet humor in the film.
There's a lot of toilet. I also really like Cary Elwes as Robin Hood. It helps that he looked a lot like Errol Flynn. And as he points out, in an obvious dig at Kevin Costner,
because, unlike some other Robin Hoods, I can speak with an English accent.
I think Cary Elwes is very much up there, and he was deliberately cast for two reasons, I think. First
what
of all,
he looks like
Errol Flynn in a certain way, but he's also just playing Wesley from The Princess Bride again.
Yes, and everybody loves The Princess Bride.
The Princess Bride is fabulous, and The Princess Bride is sending itself up the entire time, of course. That's the point of it. But he does a perfect job in this part. He's really very, very good.
I saw Robin Hood, the 1991 Robin Hood starring Patrick Bergen. Patrick Bergen is not bad as Robin Hood. There is absolutely no historical value whatsoever for this film. There isn't even a Sheriff of Nottingham. Instead, we're given a fictional Baron Roger de Geer, who begins as Robin's good friend, becomes a cruel and merciless tax collector, and ends by embracing the brotherhood of all Englishmen, Saxons as well as Normans. One can't even tell where this movie is supposed to be taking place. And instead of Guy of Gisborne, the movie gives us the brutal and obnoxious Sir Miles Folcaldet, played by Jorgen Prochnow, with an accent somewhere between French and the actor's native German. So Miles, like Sir Guy in the 1938 movie, is Robin's rival for the hand of the Lady Marian, played in this movie by Uma Thurman. And like Sir Guy, he will die in a duel with Robin. The movie echoes the 1938 film in positing the oppression of the Saxon common people by a ruthless and greedy Norman ruling class. That's really where the similarity between the two movies end. The Adventures of Robin Hood is a must-see. This film, at best, is a meh. Who am I kidding? This is a terrible film. Patrick Bergen isn't bad. Uma Thurman isn't bad. But it's a bad film with a really stupid ending. I'm not going to give a spoiler because just in case people want to see bad films, this is a bad film, and I'm not going to spoil the ending for this really, really atrocious film. We only spoil the endings of good films. Okay, I didn't see the 2018 Robin Hood with Taron Egerton as Robin.
Well, I'll take that one. This film is very, very similar to the 2017 Guy Ritchie King Arthur film, which is that it's a version of the film that is very transparently taken outside of time. It's nodding at the Middle Ages, but it's definitely not trying to be in the Middle Ages. The costumes are all basically modern. And it is very explicitly a Gulf War / Afghanistan take on Robin Hood. So Robin Hood is essentially a victim of PTSD. So he has gone off on the crusade. He's been completely disillusioned by what he's experienced there. There's a scene at the beginning that is very much urban combat, as you would find in, you know, on the streets of Baghdad or, you know, in Kabul, something like that, in which Robin Hood literally takes out a sniper nest. It happens to be a crossbow sniper nest. I mean, it's not in the least bit militarily plausible, but you, the audience, are very, very well aware of what's being evoked. And so you know that this is a soldier who's been damaged by war, and what's he going to find when he gets home? What he finds is that Maid Marian has not waited for him because he was apparently dead, so he was reported as dead. And instead, now with this other guy, who is essentially a union leader, I would say, a sort of a local councillor activist, but by the end of the film, this guy will have been co-opted, at the end of the film, the original Sheriff of Nottingham is killed, and this lover of Maid Marian, whom obviously Robin Hood comes back and reclaims, spoiler alert, this guy is set up as the new Sheriff of Nottingham. And there's clearly at the end the sense that there's going to be a sequel in which Robin will continue his vendetta against this former lover of his love, Maid Marian, who is now the sheriff. No sequel was ever made and never will be made because the film was a box office disaster. And I think for very good reason. It is not fun. In the sense that if you are going to go outside of time in the way that it does, you need to be fun like The Knight's Tale.
Yes. Written and directed by Brian Helgeland, the screenplay writer for the 2010 Russell Crowe Robin Hood, a film which is not nearly as much fun.
Which is a very fun film. The anachronisms in which bothered me not in the slightest.
You know, it's one of the favorite medieval films for medievalists.
We all love it, I think. Yeah. I mean, because it is so medieval in the sense that medieval literature doesn't worry about historical accuracy. So it fit. It was very much of a piece. But this film isn't laughing at itself. It's taking itself much too seriously. I don't think if you're going to try to comment on the Gulf War that the Robin Hood story is really the one that helps you do that.
No, I don't think so. Because at the very heart of the Robin Hood story, and I think the real attraction of it, is the idea of redistributing wealth from the unworthy few who have taken it illegitimately and distributing it to the worthy many who have worked hard for it. And this brings us to the 1950s television show, The Adventures of Robin Hood. Robin Hood, in the earliest ballads, robs the unworthy rich, but does not give the loot to the suffering poor. Only in the 15th century ballad, A Jest of Robin Hood, does he give money to a man in need. But that man is a knight made penniless by an extortionate abbot and a corrupt royal official. robbing the rich to give to the poor, however, is the hallmark of the Robin Hood legend as it crystallized in the 19th century and made its way into the 20th. This makes it an ideal vehicle for a leftist critique of social and economic injustice. And that seems to be what attracted the creator and producer of The Adventures of Robin Hood, an American journalist and left-wing activist named Hannah Weinstein. Though produced in Britain for ITV, The Adventures of Robin Hood was a response to the Red Scare and McCarthyism in the U.S. Weinstein later said that she created the show to provide work for blacklisted American screenplay writers. Among those who wrote scripts were Waldo Salt, Howard Koch, and Ring Lardner Jr., although you won't find their names in the credits as they wrote under pseudonyms to avoid the attention of studio executives. Apparently, the executives never noticed, and as far as I can tell, viewers never picked up on the political commentary. But these were first-rate scripts. This was the first and most successful Robin Hood-themed television show. It ran in Britain and the U.S. from 1955 to 1959. In all, there were 143 half-hour episodes, several of which were combined into three feature films. The series starred Richard Greene as Robin. I watched the show when I was a little kid, although the only thing I really remember about it is the catchy theme song.
Riding through the glen, Robin Hood with his band of men, feared by the bad, loved by the good, Robin Hood, Robin Hood, Robin Hood.
The episodes I watched over the last few weeks had several anachronisms, but nothing blatant enough to distract a viewer. The production values were only so-so, but the acting was consistently first-rate and the scripts featured tight plotting and literate dialogue. Several of the episodes are taken directly from the medieval ballads. Season 1's The Knight Who Came to Dinner is a faithful adaptation of the first two fits of the aforementioned 15th-century poem A Jest of Robin Hood. Other episodes are historically themed. A couple have to do with Eleanor of Aquitaine's efforts to raise ransom for King Richard and prevent her son John from allying himself with King Philip of France against the captive king. In Season 2's Ambush, Prince John, played by a very unpleasant Donald Pleasance, holds his nephew Arthur, the young Count of Brittany, whom Richard named his heir when he left on crusade.
Which is accurate.
Yes. John claims to be holding Arthur to ensure his safety, but what he's really doing, John claims that his nephew is a guest and is being kept in the Tower of London for his safety. But the boy is really his prisoner. Both Arthur and his mother, Countess Constance, suspect this, but are afraid to challenge John. John needs to dispose of Arthur without implicating himself. With the connivance of the Sheriff of Nottingham, he concocts a plan in which he will take the boy on a hunting trip to Nottingham. Along the way, the party will be waylaid by bandits, paid thugs masquerading as Robin and his men. They will kill the boy. Robin will get the blame, and a grieving John will become heir to the throne. Robin, of course, foils the dastardly plan and escorts Arthur and his mother, the Countess, back to the safety of Brittany. Now, what is wrong with this story?
Well, okay, on a very basic level, Arthur never was in England.
That's a problem.
But the other thing is that the audience may not be aware, if they're not English history nerds, but Richard and I are. Arthur will ultimately be killed.
Yes, by, a few years later.
By John. But at the time when John has already, in fact, succeeded to the throne.
Yes.
It's just that Arthur is a threat as long as he's still alive, and so he is killed. And that murder actually hangs over the rest of his reign.
It does.
It really does poison his relationships with some of his nobles.
William de Brioz.
Very much so. And helps turn sentiment against him because people do not trust somebody who would murder a child.
We really have run out of time, so I'll just mention a few other television series. These can be divided into the good, the bad, the not so bad, and the flat out ugly. The Adventures of Robin Hood is one of the good ones. Another is a much different take on the Robin Hood story, Robin of Sherwood, created by Richard Carpenter for ITV in association with Goldcrest Films and shown in the U.S. on the premium cable TV channel Showtime. Though it only ran for 3 seasons from 1984 to 1986, Robin of Sherwood is arguably the most original and influential reimagining of the Robin Hood story. Carpenter, noting the increased popular interest in mysticism, paganism, and environmentalism, introduced these elements into the tale. Robin is now the quote-unquote chosen son of Herne the Hunter, a shamanic figure who appears wearing a stag's headdress. Herne is both human and magical. His sons are to be the champions of the oppressed. Herne gives Robin a bow and the magic sword Albion, wrought by Waylon the Smith, as symbols of his status as the Hooded Man. We first meet Robin as a poacher, imprisoned in the dungeon of Sir Guy of Gisborne, the right-hand man of the Sheriff of Nottingham. With the aid of Lady Marian, he escapes, becomes the leader of an outlawed band which includes all the usual characters and a new one, a Saracen named Nasser.
Which is then taken up as canon. And you pretty much have to have that from then on. You get it in Prince of Thieves. You get it parodied in Men in Tights. But you'll also see it again in the 2018 Robin Hood.
Robin is at first suspicious and reluctant to assume the role of Herne's son. But when he does, Robin and his men become the good outlaws of the traditional stories, with a difference. Carpenter wanted the outlaws to feel like young, idealistic revolutionaries, underdog Saxons in a class struggle against the colonizing Normans, represented on screen by Nicholas Grace's perpetually bad-tempered and sarcastic Sheriff of Nottingham, and Robert Addy's rather hapless Guy of Gisborne. Although they include the familiar names of Little John, Friar Tuck, Much the Miller's Son, and Will Scarlet, these men are not at all that merry. Michael Praed's Robin is otherworldly and quietly charismatic. At the other extreme is Ray Winston's edgy performance as a volatile and violent Will Scarlet, man suffering from PTSD, having witnessed his wife being trampled to death by Norman mercenaries. Judy Trott's Lady Marian of Leaford is resourceful, intelligent, brave, and looks like she stepped out of a pre-Raphaelite painting. The show's production values are quite good. In fact, it was because the show was so expensive to film that it lasted only 3 seasons despite critical acclaim and devoted viewers. Robin of Sherwood combines gritty realism, history, and magic. The first 2 episodes has Robin rescue Marian from the clutches of Simon de Belem, a devil-worshipping Norman nobleman who seems to have gone a crusade so that he could learn the black arts in the Middle East and has the most dishonorable intentions when it comes to the beautiful young Saxon noblewoman Marian. He plans to marry her so that he can sacrifice her. Again, we can see the show's influence on the movie Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, which also has a devil-worshipping, in this case, Sheriff of Nottingham. By making Robin a son of Herne, Carpenter prepared for the possibility of changing stars. And when Michael Praed decided to leave the show at the end of season 2, Carpenter replaced him with Jason Connery, who plays the role of Robert, son of the Earl of Huntingdon. Robin assumes the mantle, if that's the right word, of the Hooded Man, much to the surprise of both Robin's distraught band and the Sheriff of Nottingham. Despite the show's mystical elements, Robin of Sherwood at times is really historically accurate and insightful. In season 1's episode, The King's Fool, we encounter King Richard returning from captivity in Germany. As in the traditional story, he seeks out Robin disguised as an abbot, and again, as in the traditional story, he forgives Robin and takes him into his service. But John Rhys-Davies' King Richard is not the savior that he was in earlier movies. He is alternately haughty and imperious, very conscious of his rank and shrewd. But above all, this King Richard is a soldier, eager to return to France to regain the lands that his little brother John gave away to King Philip of France. He is interested in Robin and his men because they are good fighters, not because they are champions of justice. As Little John warns an infatuated Robin, quote, "What does he care about England? How long has he ever stayed here? A few months, and he's off again, after he's drained the country of money, end quote. Richard stripped those who supported the treason of his brother, men like the Sheriff of Nottingham, of their offices and ranks, only to sell them back for money and men to prosecute his wars. The Richard of Robin of Sherwood struck me as the most authentic Richard I've seen on the screen.
I would agree with you.
In the not-so-bad category is the sixth episode BBC 1975 miniseries The Legend of Robin Hood. This is a straightforward, though streamlined, retelling of the story, which concludes with the poisoning of Robin by an abbess. Not 22 years after the return of Richard, but immediately after the king's return and Robin's pardon. In this version, the femme fatale is the sister of Guy of Gisborne, who poisons Robin in an act of revenge for having killed her brother in a duel. In the bad category is Mel Brooks' 1975 single-season 13 episode, When Things Were Rotten. The humor is very broad, on the level of a Norman telling complaining Saxon peasants to hold their tongues, which, of course, they do, literally. Brooks's movie, Robin Hood Men in Tights, recycles the best bits and is a lot better. And in the downright ugly category is The New Adventures of Robin Hood, which tries really hard to appeal to a teenaged audience. In the first episode, Robin and his merry men rescue an English village from a robber band of Mongols.
Mongols?
Mongols.
How did they get there?
Good question. Next month, I'm going to be having an episode with Dr. Nick Morton, author of Mongol Storm. And when I do, I'm going to ask him, how did the Mongols get to England? Because this has really been bothering me.
Well, you know, they got to England in the pages of Matthew Paris.
Maybe that's what it's from.
Right, which is, of course, from around 1250. But, you know, he wrote about the Mongols, and we have this fabulous illustration of the Mongol atrocities.
And but what about the nifty weapons that this new Robin Hood has, in which he can shoot multiple people at the same time?
Well, you know, it's interesting how the past tends to be penetrated by the present.
Oh. There is nothing medieval about the new adventures of Robin Hood. They make no attempt to get the costumes or the setting correct. Maid Marian actually looks like a biker chick in the skimpiest costume of any Maid Marian. She looks like she's wearing a sexy Marian outfit for a Halloween party. The New Adventures of Robin Hood is, as you might guess, at the bottom of my list. But, to be fair, it has the same vibe as Hercules, The Legendary Journeys with Kevin Sorbo, and Xena, Warrior Princess, which were produced at the same time. There's a campiness about the show, and some people might actually find it enjoyable. I just didn't. At any rate, what can we conclude?
Well, I think it's a little bit like with the King Arthur stories, which is that you get the Robin Hood that you need in your particular time. So Robin Hood is going to comment on whatever is going on at the period. We get Errol Flynn commenting on the 1930s social dynamics in Depression-era United States. And we get an increasing focus on a critique of foreign wars in the 1990s and onward. Robin and Marian, of course, we didn't mention, is very much a post-Vietnam version of Robin. So this is the disillusioned warrior returning from the Crusades, and the Crusades are being cast as the Vietnam War. So this shouldn't surprise us. I think this is how culture works. A myth like Robin Hood is flexible enough to accommodate the changes in culture and have something still that is coherent at the core that we're always going to recognize.
I can't have a episode where I completely ignore Monty Python. And Time Bandits has an episode in which we see a version of Robin Hood played by John Cleese. And he's an upper-class twit. John Cleese was later asked about it, and he said that he was playing Charles, Prince of Wales, now King Charles III.
Well, that's not a bad model for what he was aiming for.
So I think that's it for today. thank you very much for joining the podcast again.
It was wonderful fun, as always.
And if you take nothing else from this, see 1938, The Adventures of Robin Hood with Errol Flynn, and Princess Bride.
Absolutely. Unmissable, both of them.
Exactly.
Well, that was really, really fun, Richard.
It was fun. It was a lot of fun. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye for now.
Riding through the glen, Robin Hood with his band of men, feared by the bad, loved by the good, Robin Hood, Robin Hood, Robin Hood.